Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm joined by our regular hosts, Drs. Scott Keith, Adam Francisco, and Rod Rosenblatt. Today we're going to talk about C.S. Lewis a little more. If you've listened to us in the past, we've done a couple episodes mentioning Lewis. We did a whole episode talking sort of just like a broad scope of Lewis's work and his impact on Christianity in our Great Thinkers of the Christian Church series. He was one of the last ones that we did, which is, it was a really great episode. I think it was probably our most popular episode ever, which is pretty crazy. I mean, C.S. Lewis really is still just a massive figure in modern Christianity.
And for good reason.
Yeah, yep. That's absolutely true. And one of the things is we get asked to cover more when possible, right? And we're going to do that today. We've talked about C.S. Lewis's Case for Christianity / Mere Christianity. They're separate books, but Case for Christianity is contained within Mere Christianity. Dr. Rosenblatt will flesh that out a little bit when we talk about it. He's all about kind of the distinction and why one is accessible and why you might, you know, want both. And we're going to talk about that because we've mentioned it in our apologetic series a couple wow, that was almost 2 years ago. That's kind of weird to think about. So in our apologetic series, we've talked about it in the various episodes where we've mentioned Lewis. We talked about it in our book recommendation episode that we just did about a month and a half ago, where we just sat here and talked about a lot of books. Well, we mentioned both of those in there as well as things that people should consider. And so we're going to do that on the show today, and we're going to break things up a little bit. We're going to cover over the course of 3 episodes the entirety of the content of Mere Christianity, but we're going to start with the various books that are actually in that collection.
Yeah, what we call Mere Christianity was a British publisher, Macmillan, who decided to glue 3 Lewis books together. Mm-hmm. The Case for Christianity. Next one glued on was Beyond Personality, Beginning Steps in the Doctrine of the Trinity. And the third one they decided to glue into the thing was Christian Behavior. All of those were individual, very small, thin hardbacks when originally published in England. So you can get it in either format, but I really recommend, if you can find it, to get a paperback of The Case for Christianity on its own, and there's a practical evangelistic reason for that. A guy will see that book and say, I could read that this weekend. If you give him Mere Christianity, he'll say to himself, maybe next year on vacation. In other words, it looks winnable.
Yeah. So before we get too far into the show, I just wanted to remind listeners that The Thinking Fellows is part of the 1517 Podcasting Network. You can find that at 1517legacy.com/podcast. There, every week, we produce over 8 hours of new audio content on various topics. One of those, about just short of one of those hours a week, is The Thinking Fellows, which you're currently listening to. If you'd like to find more great Christ-centered content, you should go check it out. Again, that's 1517legacy.com/podcast. There you can check out every single one of the shows. We started off with 8. We're working our way towards probably 12 by the end of this year, which is a really crazy concept. There's a lot of great weekly shows there, and we're starting this new seasonal concept, which has been big in video for quite a long time. Think Netflix and Hulu, right, where you drop whole seasons at a time that you can watch at your leisure, or binge them if is a popular thing, right?
We're gonna. You might want to explain what binging means to Adam.
Oh, I'm sure he knows. He's familiar. And then we're going to do that same type of thing with podcasts now, where we drop about 10 or 12 episodes annually or biannually, depending on who is doing the show and what that means. And so that's going to be pretty cool. Some of those are going to be Bible study type things where, you know, say somebody wants to lead a Bible study with helps and books and audio involved in those types of things. You can download all 12 episodes of this particular show. Maybe there's a book that goes along with it, and you use those to get through 12 weeks of a Bible study, say at your church. So there's some pretty cool ideas happening here, so watch out for that kind of thing coming soon. Okay, guys, so today we're going to talk about the case for Christianity. This is an apologetic work, so this episode kind of falls in the vein of apologetics, which is something we haven't done a specific apologetic episode in a little while, so it's good to get back on this track. And at the same time, we're covering a great thinker and a book, so this is a pretty all-encompassing episode. So where does Lewis start, and why is that helpful to the, let's say, the new Christian or the atheist or the person who's engaging in apologetics?
Having read Aquinas and the other greats, and other theologians have not, he starts with right and wrong as a clue to the meaning of the universe, and then parries questions that come to him. He mentally does that. He knows what he's going to be asked, and he does it. That we have some sort of law of decent behavior built into us by being human, and he's going to defend that. That we somehow know something about a moral law or the basics of behavior. Somehow, for instance, somebody will be a complete linguistic relativist and say, ah, balderdash. And Lewis says, but let that guy have his pocket picked at the fair. And he'll yell out, hey, you, come back here. That's my wallet. Mm-hmm. He's appealing to a standard above them both. So the other was just a word game. When it comes down to it, he acknowledges it when he has his pocket picked. So Lewis is first of all starting out with the reality of the law to the whole race.
I always thought that this was a fun one to do with students at the university because most of them, yeah, probably in all ages, but my frame of reference is the last 10 years or so,
sure,
believe themselves, for the most part, to be moral relativists, even if they wouldn't express it that way.
Yeah, even if they don't understand the phrase, if you explain the phrase to them, they'll say, that's what I am.
Yeah, and it's sort of, I'm sure the phrase isn't hip anymore, but the YOLO.
Yeah. You only live once.
You only live once, and the you do you, yep, type thing, you know, where, you know, you do what's right for you, I'll do what's right for me, and don't tell me what's right for me, and I won't tell you what's right for you, and we'll all get along. This one's kind of fun to do with them in a classroom. Even if, I mean, what the downside to it is, it takes a while for him to get to Christ. I'll say that. That's a downside to him. But as a conversation opener, this is pretty good. Uh-huh. And it's always fun to do in a classroom because before you know it, the students are giving you their examples of what somebody else couldn't do to them or somebody that they love, mm-hmm, without their you know, vehement objection to such behavior. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of fun, you know, because it doesn't take long at all. And that's the thing about this. I love the backstory to this, Rod. I mean, Lewis, this is originally published as Radio Talks,
yep,
right?
Yep. Given during the Blitz, he had gone to Churchill and said, what can I do for the war effort?
Right.
Obviously wounded in World War I, couldn't do that. Churchill said, you can, better than our priests, you know how to tell these young people how to go to heaven. And the priests are unable to do it. If you will do that at the RAF bases every single night, that's the best thing you can do. And it was the time of the Blitz.
Right. So the RAF bases are their Royal Air Force bases, and these guys are flying Spitfires
and,
you know,
and
over the channel,
yep,
into mainland Europe.
And Churchill says 10 of those boys is going to die in his cockpit.
What I always thought was sort of interesting about the first book, and Adam can help me with the history here, is one of the ways I've read this described is England was going to war for the second time in 1914 to 1918,
yep,
then back to war in 1937,
yep,
right? You know, so again, in 20 years, they're back into a quote-unquote world war. And in a lot of ways, the first one, and Adam, fix me if I'm wrong here, the first one, like the land war, didn't go so well for them. I mean, they lost a lot of men in that first
one. Yeah, the war of attrition.
Yeah.
Western Front, yeah.
And there was a lot of on the home front, there was a lot of resistance against getting into this again, right?
Sure, because a whole generation of boys was killed.
Yeah. And one of the things that Lewis accomplishes in a lot of ways in these radio talks that are broadcast, they're broadcast over the BBC, is explaining why what's going on over there with Hitler and the Nazis is actually evil.
Yeah.
Objectively.
Yes.
And why it needed to be fought.
Yep.
And so, of course, yep. in book two and book three, you actually get into the redemptive story much more so than
yep.
book one. But in book...
And by the way, the BBC lost all the tapes.
Yeah, of course. But in book one, really, there's a... It's almost like the convincing of a nation regarding, you know, the morality of why this type of behavior has to be opposed.
Yep.
Because we can actually objectively say that this is evil.
Yep. Yep.
Am I wrong, Adam?
You're right.
Okay.
Yep.
One of the other things that I think is... really interesting about this is that not only does Lewis in The Case for Christianity set out the reality of objective right and wrong, he talks about how much we know it, mm-hmm. right? We have sort of this natural knowledge of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he points out something that's right out of Romans that you might not get just on the surface of it, but that we know it, and we also know that we're not doing the right.
Yep, and that's where Lewis goes next. We know that we're failing to live up to it. And that isn't very difficult for him to establish, but he takes the time to do it. There is a moral law, and we know something about it, all of us, and we also know we fall short of it. Those are two big things to establish at the beginning. And then the next section is called the reality of the law, and he tamps it down even further. And then he goes to a section on what lies behind it. And then it's what you're starting to describe, Scott, two views of how the universe came to be.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, there used to be, a couple years ago, it was popular to put on, and we should put it up here, YouTube, those sort of chalkboard narrated graphics.
Yeah.
And somebody...
I forget who did that.
Yeah, somebody did a bunch of these out of The Case for Christianity, and they're actually really good. And it's somebody with a nice British voice that you might even mistake for C.S. Lewis narrating it as they sort of animate this thing on a chalkboard. I used to show those in class because I was never really confident that the students actually read the book.
Yeah.
And it would help further the conversation because, you know, after watching it, it was at least fresh in their mind. So,
in the best case scenario,
yeah,
right?
In the best case scenario,
their minds. I'll find that YouTube series and I'll put a link in the show notes for people to be able to go check that out.
And I'll also send you an outline of the book itself. My students have done outlines of the vast majority of Lewis's works, books as well as essays, and not all of them, but a sizable percentage of them, and then I've edited those up to publishable.
Yeah, perhaps like one of my favorite aspects of this is just the neutral starting place, as you mentioned, and this is what we sort of covered when we had Rustan on and we did natural law, right?
Was mm-hmm.
that the main benefit that had for us was a conversational starting place was equal whether we shared the same religion or not, the same culture or not.
Yep.
There was somewhere that we could discuss.
The thing that's interesting to me is something I already mentioned. Churchill's evaluation of the whole Church of England was that its priests couldn't even tell these young pilots how to go to heaven.
Well, why was that? I mean, there's a reason for that.
It was vitiated by liberalism.
Yeah, they didn't believe it themselves.
Yeah, the theological liberalism had utterly hollowed out the Church of England and its priests. They didn't believe it was true.
And made non-believers of a generation, and several generations
yep.
of children, including Lewis himself before he converts back to Christianity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons it's interesting when the late Billy Graham was having a crusade in Haringey back in the late 50s, thousands of Brits came out to hear him. Mm-hmm. Thousands. Why so many? Well, Graham was good at what he did, but that's not enough to, that doesn't explain it. The reason thousands came out to hear him was they couldn't hear it in their churches.
Right. Right.
Same as in Germany on Kirchentag. Nobody bothered to go to church anymore. There wasn't any reason to go. Their pastors were unbelievers, even if they didn't know they were. And then when there's Kirchentag and you have special speakers who do believe the scriptures, they come out by the thousands. Now, that's a ways back, but it's telling. If you want to have a church that has nothing to say to the culture, just let your seminaries go liberal.
Well, and it too explains a lot of the reason, I think, for the power of Lewis in his era. I mean, not only is he brilliant and exceptionally, you know, wonderful writer and author, but two, he believed, by the time he's converted back to Christianity and then he starts writing about this stuff, he believes vehemently in the truth.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He said, I took my first communion in total unbelief.
Right. And he believes in the truth of the resurrection, and yep. then he sets about defending it.
Yep.
And defending it as true in the face of the sort of intellectual climate of his time.
Yep.
But is enough of an intellectual himself that he can answer the charges that come at him for belief. And this is where his whole idea of, you know, coming to believe that he lives in an era of chronological snobbery and that
yeah. And he identifies himself as a translator.
Yeah.
I'm just taking the message of early Christianity and translating it for the guy on the street in London.
Yeah.
And he also said to the priests during that lecture, had you done your duty for years and years and years,
I wouldn't have to.
There would be no need for somebody like me.
Right. Yeah.
Before we head to our break in a couple of minutes, I just wanted to tell listeners how the availability of this and how they can buy it. Typically, I'm going to put these links in the show notes, but typically you can get these on Amazon. There's two ways that you can do this. You can either buy Mere Christianity, and this will be the
first 57 pages.
Yes, in there. And that's about $10 on Amazon. Then if you want it as just the Case for Christianity, say for your own reading or even to give away, as uh-huh. Dr. Rosenblatt has mentioned, that its compact size really lends itself to somebody's confidence in being able to get through the material. You can buy that on Amazon as well. Ironically, that one is like $3 more, even though it's a third the amount of the pages.
Gotta love publishers.
Yeah, you gotta love publishers and Amazon. Popularity has a lot to do with price.
Yep, that's right.
Both would make great additions to your library. And like we've said, Case for Christianity on its own is a really good giveaway. We at 1517 like the small pamphlet style.
We sure do.
Things because
yes.
Well, just in my experience, you know, somebody may begin reading a tome or a longer book and then stop. It's just our lives are pretty busy. People are working all the time. Weekends are with families, catching up on
Netflix.
Your favorite Netflix series. I mean,
binging on Netflix.
Let's be real.
Hey, you do know what it means.
let's be real. People don't read as much as they used to. So, you know, if that's more in your interest, you can still get that. I'll put both the links to that in the show notes.
And you'll see in these outlines, there are about 350 to 400 of them now. Where you can get an overview with some detail, not just a table of contents, but you really can, in 6 or 8 pages, see the total scope of the book, the view from 30,000 feet.
You can certainly trace the argument.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very cool. All right, we're going to head to our break, and then we'll be right back. Hello there, and welcome to our break. Today we're going to do a book by one of the hosts of the show, Dr. Adam Francisco. He co-authored/edited this book. It's called The Resurrection Fact, Responding to Modern Critics. I thought we would do this today because we're talking about a book that is apologetic in nature, and this is an apologetic book that, much like Case for Christianity, is attempting to deal with modern problems for us, which There's definitely overlap with the problems described in Case for Christianity.
Yeah, and modern society. And the only Lutheran apologist for decades has been Dr. Montgomery.
Well,
and finally, what?
You.
And oh,
you,
yeah. I've just...
You're no mean apologist yourself.
But finally, we're having men like Dr. Francisco and others who are following in that train, that factual defense of the truth of the gospel. That's, for Lutherans, amazing.
Yeah, and this is an absolutely great book. It's accessible. It's broken down into chapters that can be read individually if need be or want, which, again, following that theme of accessibility is great. Adam, could you describe kind of the character of the book a little further?
Yeah, what you just said is right. In fact, it's the chapters are not linked in one continuous narrative. They're, you know, every chapter tackles a different challenge to the, you know, historic Christian faith. In particular, or it addresses a particular challenge to explaining why the tomb was empty Easter morning. And most chapters deal with a particular skeptical author of some import. Several of them deal with Bart Ehrman.
You know, good.
Probably the
good.
Most widely read New Testament scholar in the United States. It starts off with Mark Pearson's chapter on the reliability of the reports of the resurrection. Mm-hmm. Moves into, if you will, a chapter on the so-called problem of miracles. And then takes the rest of the book. The next six chapters address these New Testament scholars who will explain away the empty tomb by saying that maybe it was this mass hallucination.
Yep.
Or maybe...
I've always thought that was an interesting thing, that you'd make your career in teaching the New Testament and then try to explain away the most cogent and powerful parts of the New Testament.
Yeah, well, he went to Moody.
Yeah.
He went to Moody. He knew right where the knife goes.
Yeah. That's funny. That explains an encounter I had last year, but I'll leave it at
but
that.
If you go to, not that this is about Bart Ehrman here, but if you read his book, God's Problem, there's a little autobiography in there. He's mad at God because of the problem of evil. He lost his father very early on. So it seems, it is interesting. I think there's, not that we can know it or not that this should be the focus of any sort of apologetic, but a lot of objections to Christianity from those who should otherwise know better or who are invested in...
Are emotional.
Emotional or psychological, yeah.
When I teach on the problem of evil, I'll say that. And like, you know, I don't do anything unique. I just sort of parrot what Dr. Montgomery has done in Sensible Christianity and other places on that. But I always try to start it out somewhat pastorally and say, if you want to know sort of philosophical answers to the problem of evil because somebody in your life says they don't believe because of, you know, essentially the problem of evil, you ought to sort of take a breath and ask them, you know, why is this such a problem for you? And 9 times out of 10,
it's existential.
It's existential.
Yep.
Yeah. Just exactly what you described of Ehrman. never the church addressed when their father died when they were six.
Yeah.
Yeah. It has a tremendous motor ability in it.
Or their mother, who's the best person they ever knew, just died in a car accident last year.
Yes.
And they can't understand why God would take such a good person from them, type of thing.
Yep.
You know? And it's, so anyway.
And I got to say, a lot of American evangelical language towards these types of things does not help these.
No, it's God's
people.
Plan.
Yeah.
She's in a better place.
No.
Soul-making theodicies, right?
Yeah. They really are.
Yeah.
Ick.
Yeah. Ick is the best way to describe it. Back to the book, though. So there's a chapter in there that addresses you don't find this so much in academic literature, but you do find it in in the realm of media and the internet, this claim that Christianity is just a big ripoff of Egyptian mythology, dying and rising.
So Isis and Osiris.
Yeah.
So redone.
A chapter dealing with that, a chapter dealing with New Testament scholars, like I said a bit earlier.
Might be a good theory, except for the eyewitness accounts.
Yes.
And the fact that all these Egyptian myths, the actual literature for it doesn't appear until after the New Testament's written.
So the authors
couldn't even look at these books to know that. They may have heard the stories orally.
In general, with myth, real myth, what makes myth, is that it took place nowhere and everywhere always and never.
Yeah. Well, that's, yeah. I mean, that's a good segue. I mean, we're not segueing yet back to Lewis, because one of his comments regarding the claim that the New Testament is myth is, hey, I know myth. Myth is my field.
Yeah. Norse myth.
Yeah. If this is myth, this is not good myth.
Yes. I wish I could remember that it's in Christian Reflections.
Yeah.
And I can't remember the title of the chapter, but it's one time was done in Christianity Today, the whole text of the chapter, and it was titled Faulting the Bible Critics. But if you have a copy of Christian Reflections, one of those essays is Lewis going after that charge.
Right.
Yeah. I heard I've recently heard some abandoning of the four Gospels as myth and picking up the myth of Paul. Myth of the Apostle Paul.
That's a really hard one.
Yeah. Yep.
Good.
Very
grief.
Interesting.
Yeah.
They
like see Adam's face. You can't see your podcast, so you can't see Adam's face, but it's sort of like what?
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe in the next edition.
Some
of
issues are just better settled in the alley.
So to get back, the Resurrection Fact is available at shop.1517legacy.com. It's also on Amazon. It's very reasonably priced. It's about $16. If you're new to the 1517 shop, you can get another 10% off by signing up with your email address on the homepage there. We've had some listeners be like, why didn't my code pop back up? It actually gets sent to your email address, or when it does pop up on the screen, make sure to write it down. It doesn't automatically apply to your cart. You gotta type it in during checkout. So just keep that in mind when you do that. But yeah, you can get an extra 10% off on our site if you're a first-time shopper there. So that's pretty cool there. Again, it's about $16. It's accessible. It's not long in its entirety, but like Dr. Francisco said, it's not a continuous narrative. So if there's a particular issue perhaps somebody has brought to you, it's probably covered here if it's a modern academic argument, and you can then kind of see what the research standing against those things is.
Another thing I think we should include in the show notes is the fellow, I think he's at Baylor. He does an audio series on Lewis, and it's available through the, what's it called, the teaching company. And man, does he know his stuff. He's at Baylor, and it's from the teaching company, and sometimes goes on sale for cheap. But I can't recommend it highly enough. He is, you know, I know something about Lewis, and I can't find a single proposition in five lectures by this guy where there's a single factual error in it. I mean, he really, really knows his stuff. I don't know if it's available beyond the teaching company, but it is available there.
The series, the free series at Hillsdale's not bad either.
Really, I tried the first lecture, and it seemed to me he was more complex than Lewis.
Well, that was the first couple lectures. Is their president? What's his name, Adam?
Arn,
Larry Arn.
Yeah, and they bring on some solid Lewis scholars, and it gets.
Well, the guy I listened to was an Oxford scholar. I maybe missed Arn's intro, but I thought, gosh, it's refreshing to read Lewis compared to listening to this guy lecture about who Lewis is and what he thought.
That's funny.
And it was at that time I said, I don't think I'll get the series from Hillsdale.
Yeah. Well, it's free.
Maybe I should. You bought it?
No, it's free.
Oh, it's free.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Free. You just got to give me your email.
Okay.
And then you get three emails a day.
Well, I know. It's theoretically free.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago, there was a conference on Lewis here. Is that an annual thing, or was that just there, one time?
It's at this Classical Academy in Newport Beach. And
Pacifica Christian Academy.
Their conference is every year. I'm not sure it's on Lewis every year.
There's a C.S. Lewis Institute up near Redlands, and they've taken groups to England to redo the kilns, you know, painting and other kinds of work to bring them back up to snuff. But that thing was a major Lewis source. It's worth looking and see if you can find the C.S. Lewis Institute, and it's somewhere here in Southern California. And I think
Redlands, that's not too far from us, Caleb.
That is not too far from us. Yeah. It's about a 45-minute drive down the mountain.
Yeah.
Yeah, we should maybe take a stop one of these days.
I've read a little Lewis. That'd be fun.
It'd be great.
Well, there are thousands of us who owe our first consideration of Christianity through the question, is it true, to Lewis.
Right.
There are thousands of us.
I think one of the things that he does so well, probably better than even, you know, some people, for how intense of an academic he was, his ability to write...
clear English.
Clear English, and to write briefly.
Yeah, is, almost no polysyllabic words.
Is astounding.
Yeah. It is astounding.
I mean, it's,
and it also was academic suicide for him.
Right.
To yeah. write to write we, for the laity, it right. ended his progress.
Yeah, we were just talking about that at the break, how he's years and years and years at Magdalen College, Oxford, and he doesn't get a full professorship until almost his death at Cambridge, right? I think 5 years before he dies, he
incredible.
Goes to Cambridge, something like that. But most academics, when they write, especially like on something like apologetics, where you, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot of philosophy, a lot of history,
yes,
they tend to sort of stay in their field, and you know, in their head, in their field, and they write as though they're writing for other people in their field. Lewis yes. just does not do that,
right? Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, and that's just across that's across the board.
Yeah,
I mean,
other than his stuff, medieval, Renaissance English right. literature. Other than that, everything that he wrote for lay Christians has those attributes.
Yeah.
It is straightforward English prose, and you can understand it. Now, maybe the concept is difficult, but he's not going to screw it up with a bunch of academic long words.
And he even takes the concept, which is difficult, like natural law, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he can, by way of examples and analogies, mm-hmm. and you know, real-life tie-ins, is able to bring it down to earth in a way that is completely understandable by the everyday layman. I mean, completely. That's the case for Christianity. I mean, that's what it does. Again, to reiterate, in a lot of ways, that book was used for two reasons. One, to sort of say there is true evil and we can recognize it and it's objective, and there's true mm-hmm. good and we can recognize it and it's objective.
Mm-hmm.
And then to, you know, to both use that to inspire, to fight, and to convict in order to lead to book two, which is going to give you much more of the redemption in Christ and
yep.
that type of thing. And
yep.
But very difficult concepts made very easy to understand.
Absolutely.
By one of the most brilliant men that's yeah. lived in the last yeah. 100 years.
There was one fellow who wrote a book on why Lewis had the effect that he had. I can't remember the name of it. I'll get it to you, Caleb. C.S. Lewis's Case for the Christian Faith, I think, was the okay. title.
Yeah, yeah.
C.S. Lewis.
Pertil, I think.
Maybe it was Pertil up in Washington. Really? Yeah, Roman Catholic up in yeah. State University in Western Washington. Dick Pertil.
Yeah. Steve Mueller at Concordia University Irvine wrote his dissertation on C.S. Lewis, and it became a book
mm-hmm. titled Not Something. Not a Tame
Not
Lion?
Not a Tame God.
Not
and
a
then
tame
listen,
God.
Somewhere in the subtitle, I think, is C.S. Lewis has translated theology or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That he was always working at translating the academic scholarly side for
right.
the rest
and
of us.
Of course, that title's a play on the phrase from The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. He's
sure.
not a tame lion.
And the, sure. and the cover.
And he blamed me for it. He said, it's you that set me up for this, doing this.
Yeah.
You did that to a lot of people.
I was actually pretty lucky. It was just over a year ago, but there wasn't a lot of opportunity for independent study while I was at Concordia. Unless you hit up the dean of your respective school, and Dr. Mueller was my dean, and he happily did an independent study on Lewis with me.
Oh, did he?
Just yeah. fantastic, because, you know, it wasn't offered as a class or tidbits of Lewis here and there, and I knew that, you know, that's what he did his dissertation
sure.
on, and
we should get him on the show.
Yeah, we should try to get him on the show. Yeah. I think that'd be fun.
I think he'd do it.
And that was great, because, you know, he just let me read, and then mm-hmm. we'd meet, and we'd discuss what I read, and that was just a really refreshing class that semester, because it wasn't weekly, and it was just him saying, here's what I think you should read. What did you want to read? And then
mm-hmm.
I come do this about Lewis.
Great.
And that was a really fun opportunity.
Great. Wonderful to have opportunities like that. Then the university gets organized and they just start disappearing.
That's how he taught me theological German 20-some-odd years ago.
Huh. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was really cool because independent study, I did a couple independent studies at Concordia, not a lot, and that was the easiest one to get because Dean Signature kind of just
carries. Well, they had me teach it my last years there. That's right. You weren't in there, but I think it was by student request.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. Sure it was.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. So just to end, sort of, we have a couple minutes, and so I wanted to get back on to towards the end of Case for Christianity.
The telos of it all. Yeah. Where he puts forward the great trilemma.
Right. Yeah, the fifth section is called We Have Cause to Be Uneasy. Mm-hmm. After doing four chapters of us knowing the law and not obeying it or being able to obey it even, Lewis said he discovered the force of the law by deciding one time that he was going to be a more moral guy.
Yeah.
And it just ended up in shards of
that's
on the
often
floor.
How you discover the force.
Yeah.
By deciding you're going to do better.
Yeah. Going to be a better guy.
Yeah.
So, and he closes by saying, remember, we have not gotten anywhere near the God of any actual religion, especially not the God of Christianity, not yet. So that closing section is an invitation to, if you stay with this, I'm going to offer you why Christianity ought to be believed, but not here. I'm just going to try to entice you by the explanatory power and the factual basis for the Christian faith.
Yeah. I think that's an interesting tell. I mean, we often, even our pastors and ourselves, are apt to teach and to preach that if you want to find the full force of the law, you have to go deep into your depravity, right? But more often than not, I think we find the full force of the law when we're actually trying to be good.
Mm-hmm.
Because what the law exposes, really, is your inability to be good.
Yeah.
And
the gospel, it is so difficult for people who are good.
Yeah.
You know, to preach the gospel to those that we really sort of admire.
Well, and our ability to be bad is sort of clear to us.
Yes.
Yeah. But our inability to be good is sort of a foreign concept until we hit it hard. I mean, I could even think of this as, you know, book one is sort of a introduction to the reality that we're all theologians of glory.
Yes. Right?
You know? And it's not until book two until you get into a little bit of the theology of the cross.
Yeah.
Right? But this entire book one is, it's convincing you that we're all theologians of glory. We're all setting up this idea that we're better than we are.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's this section that, you know, you tend to want to read Lewis into your tradition, right? Everybody thinks, Lewis was kind of a closet Lutheran.
Right,
no, he was
right.
A Roman Catholic. No, he was.
Mm-hmm.
But it's this section when you get to a mere Christianity that as a Lutheran, you recognize the proper distinction of the theology of the law and the gospel here.
Yeah.
Yep.
Anybody know Lewis's sources?
Gosh.
And where did he learn this type of argument? I know there's a long history of it, but...
He would say very humbly, when he was asked why theologians' arguments just didn't have much power or didn't make much sense, he very humbly said, well, we just read different books. Well, he read the classics. They didn't.
I think you can see a layman's translation of some Aquinas here.
Mm-hmm.
I really do.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Aquinas does in 650 pages what Lewis does in 50 here.
Yeah. And he also knew his Augustine.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, the greats. And many times it became recognizable as he wrote these simple books. People said, I've belonged to the church my whole life long. Why hasn't anybody taught me this? Well, finally it was down at the level where it went, aha!
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very cool. Oh, you had something to add before I wrap up?
No, I was going to say that the point that Dr. Rosenblatt just brought up, that when people say, why has nobody taught me this? That was my experience when I first learned apologetics from you.
Yeah, like, me too.
Wait a minute. This is... Yeah. Like, defensible? There's a factual basis for this?
And kind of straightforward, yeah, too. Yeah. You know?
Well, like, our
this church isn't as hard as I thought it was
going to be. I was like, yeah. Wow, this changes everything. I can actually speak.
Yeah. Well, we haven't had anybody do it except for you for 5 years at Fort Wayne. We haven't anybody in our circles do it for a century other than Dr. Montgomery, and they never invited him to do anything.
Yeah. We just got to get Adam back at Fort Wayne, right, Adam?
Oh, gosh. who would want to do that to a guy?
Oh. Fort Wayne was wonderful.
Hey, thank you, Adam.
The weather was good.
Before we get into any sort of mischaracterizations.
Yeah.
But in reality, though, a lot of times in Lutheran circles, when you hear the word apologetic, it'll be followed the apologetic for Lutheranism against other Christians, and you're just kind of like,
yeah, those are polemics.
It gets old.
Yeah,
those are polemics. That's not the same. Showing why the Jehovah's Witnesses are today's Arians isn't the same,
or showing why Lutheran is the only true form of Orthodox Christianity.
Yeah, that sort of thing.
That's not apologetic.
No,
and that is a common. Misrepresentation that I see all the time when people, even people say in this show, it'd be like, well, I'll use that material against the Jehovah's and the Mormons. Like, well, that's fine, but that's not the same as what we're trying to really present here. I mean, it is useful, right? I actually had some Mormons coming to my house for a couple of weeks, and one of the things that I brought up was, the authority of their scriptures.
Sure.
And it kind of broke them, and they stopped coming to my house. But
I took them out to breakfast.
Yeah.
And paid for it.
I don't mind. That's to me, that's a little different than saying apologetics is the defense of Lutheranism over and above Calvinism.
Correct.
That's polemic.
That's polemic.
Yeah, you're in a whole. I mean, you're still kind of within systematics, but you're in a different.
It's a different area.
Part of systematics.
Yeah. Apologetics is 1 Peter 3:15, but always be prepared to offer a reasoned defense for the hope that is within you, yet do it with gentleness.
And what you'll never find C.S. Lewis doing is any type of polemics like that.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah.
In fact, even in the next book, when he goes over atonement, he sort of is reticent to answer the questions. And when he does, he says, from what I've read via various traditions, boom, and the scriptures, and lays out sort of what he thinks makes sense.
Thank God he chose in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, he chose penal theory.
Yeah, you see, yeah, and, I we should talk about that, because I see a couple there.
Yeah,
there,
I see
but
more
certainly,
than one.
Yeah. But certainly penal.
Yeah, the one that's in danger in our day is penal theory.
Yeah, I mean, certainly that's absolutely true. But you get other pictures.
You do.
Too.
Yeah,
for sure.
Well, Luther did the same thing. He threw some Christus Victor in after he'd done 10 illustrations of penal and substitution. Then he'd throw in Christus Victor.
Yeah, I mean, the stone table breaks.
Yeah.
Right.
That signifies maybe another picture, too.
Exchange, a false payment to the witch. There's things like that.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I think he does beautifully in The Lion, the Witch, of the Wardrobe, he sort of
cuts through
eliminates the argument by sort of giving you an overall biblical perspective on atonement there. And I think the same thing happens in the second book of Mere Christianity.
Well, this was a fun episode. Again, it's always a joy to kind of revisit some of this Lewis material, especially now as we're trying to get into some of the specific things that he's written instead of just kind of the overarching picture of what he's, the impact that he's had. Thank you for listening to this show and any other episodes. If you've enjoyed our talks now and in the past, please go and subscribe to the show on your favorite podcasting app, whether that be on your phone. Now, there are a couple that work on computers if that's the way you prefer to access things online. You can go to thinkingfellows.com and you can see links to where you can subscribe, where you can contact us about questions and things like that. There's also a donate button there if you'd like to support the show. Once again, thank you for listening, and we'll catch you next time.